Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, Trump's trip to Asia. Also, the meaning of Tuesday's election results and contrasting the House and Senate's tax plan. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? And more sex and rape scandals by men in power. Our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore defiantly is denying allegations that he sexually molested a 14-year-old and pursued other teenagers when he was a local prosecutor in his 30s decades ago. The Washington Post reported that Moore met Lee Korfman several times and at one point drove her to his home where he touched her over her bra and underpants and guided her hand to touch him over his underwear. Aside from Korfman, three other women interviewed by the Post said Moore pursued them when they were between the ages of 16 and 18. None of the other women said Moore forced them into sexual contact. Moore is the Republican candidate running to take Attorney General Jeff Sessions' Senate seat in a special election next month. The Moore campaign called the report fake news and defamation. Former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon is a staunch Moore supporter. He compared the Washington Post report to last year's publication of the Access Hollywood tape on which Donald Trump bragged about how he sexually assaulted women and got away with it.
The Bezos Amazon Washington Post that dropped that dime on Donald Trump is the same Bezos Amazon Washington Post that dropped the dime this afternoon on Judge Roy Moore. Now, is that a coincidence? That's what I mean when I say opposition party.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters traveling with Trump in Asia that the president believes a mere allegation, especially one from many years ago, shouldn't be allowed to destroy a person's life. But Sanders said the president also believes if these allegations are true, Judge Moore will do the right thing and step aside. On Capitol Hill, Republican senators echoed that view. This is Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby.
It's a devastating, nasty story. If the revelations, if that's true, I don't believe there'd be any place for him in the U.S. Senate.
Moore has been favored to win next month's special election. The Wall Street Journal reports that special counsel Robert Mueller is investigating whether fired Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was involved in a plan to kidnap dissident Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who is living in the U.S., and deliver him to Turkey for a payment of $15 million. The journal reports that people familiar with the probe said the plan involved both Flynn and his son, Michael Flynn Jr. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused Gulen of masterminding a 2016 failed coup attempt. Erdogan has urged the U.S. to extradite Gulen. Donald Trump is in Vietnam. In a speech there, he denounced multilateral agreements embraced by the region and delivered what appeared to be a rebuke to China immediately after visiting there.
They engaged in product dumping, subsidized goods, currency manipulation, and predatory industrial policies.
Trump is attending the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Russian President Vladimir Putin is there, too. The White House said the two will not hold a formal meeting. They exchanged brief remarks earlier today. A group of 20 House Republicans is urging Speaker Paul Ryan to act quickly on legislation that would protect 800,000 young immigrants brought to this country as children. The lawmakers said efforts to grant such deportation protection would easily pass the House, with dozens in the Republican Party joining Democrats to back legislation. Florida Republican Ileana Ross Leighton made her pitch in English and Spanish.
Sometimes in the press, you read about, the Republicans don't want to help young people to realize their dreams. Well, here you have living proof of why that is not true. There's a whole bunch of us who want to make this dream a reality, and I stand ready to work alongside them. Nosotros los republicanos sí queremos ayudar a los soñadores. Queremos que ellos puedan realizar ese sueño. Los Estados Unidos es su casa.
The so-called Dreamers are facing an uncertain future after Donald Trump's decision to end Obama-era DACA protections. Trump has given Congress until March to come up with a fix. The 20 Republicans endorsing action did not specify details of a legislative fix or whether they would support the DREAM Act, which is a bipartisan-sponsored bill giving young immigrants permanent legal status. House Speaker Paul Ryan responded shortly after the Republican call for action. He said active discussions are underway about the issue, but sees no need to act before Trump's March deadline. Hundreds of young immigrants walked out from 9 schools in the Washington area and rallied in front of Congress demanding speedy action. One called Ryan's statement that there's no urgency a slap in the face, saying, "How are we supposed to celebrate the holidays being afraid of being deported?" I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we'd like to welcome our roundtable. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues in America's Update of Fortune and others. She's a columnist for the Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, commentator on NPR, Al Jazeera, BBC, and Mexican television and radio station. She has participated as an analyst and activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border. She is the host of her own television program in Mexico. Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
And Jackie Goldberg, who served in the California State Assembly and also as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Prior to serving on the council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. She's currently on contract with the mayor of Los Angeles with his office to help with his plan called Service and Workforce Restoration, a program whose goals are to hire 5,000 permanent city employees by 2018 to restore service that was cut or curtailed by layoffs. Jackie Goldberg has been an educator all of her life. Welcome, Jackie.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And Dr. Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. And Dr. Horn, tell us the title of your two latest books, because you write faster than most of us read.
Storming the Heavens, which is basically about the Black experience with aviation, and The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, this major news gathering agency in existence for 50 years until 1967.
Now, we're going to start off our discussion today with what's happening in Asia. Donald Trump is there. He's been wooing leaders in China, Japan, Vietnam, and others in his trip to Asia. He has reiterated his America First policy and opposed any multilateral agreements. He said the U.S. was only interested in bilateral country-to-country agreements. In Vietnam, where, by the way, he lashed out against China, even though he didn't call China by name as having unfair trade agreements. But in Vietnam, APEC is meeting. The APEC members are Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Peru, Philippines, Russia, Singapore, Taiwan, Thailand, the United States, and Vietnam. Now, Trump is referring to the region as the Indo-Pacific region. He seems to be banking on driving a wedge between India and China, hoping that China's large and growing economy can be a balance to China's growing influence in the region. But we have to remember that both China and India are part of an economic bloc called the BRICS. So we'll see how all of that works out. Now, President Xi of China, in contrast, continued China's bid to be the leader supporting multilateralism and globalization. He opposed the isolationism put forward by Trump. The disagreements between the world's largest economies, the U.S. and China, emerge for all to see, not when Trump was in China, but in Vietnam, where, as I said, APEC meetings are taking place. President Xi of China also called for more progress on the free trade area of the Asia Pacific and to finish negotiations on the 16-nation Asia Trade Pact called RCEP. While much is being made by the Trump administration about trade deals on this trip, his Secretary of State said on Thursday, quote, quite frankly, in the grand scheme of $300 to $500 billion trade deficit, the things that have been achieved thus far are pretty small. That's Rex Tillerson. But there is some good news for the U.S. financial services sector and for Trump. China announced on Friday that it will loosen some of the controls of China's financial sector and allow for more foreign ownership. While this has the U.S. banking sector licking its chops, according to Reuters, China is basically positioning itself as a major global finance hub. Now, when it comes to Russia, the Trump administration had said there will be no formal meeting between Putin and Trump, but did not rule out what is called a bilat, in which a one-on-one meeting on the sidelines, right? And if a bilat doesn't happen, there's also something called a pull aside, which during a dinner or a ceremonial event, leaders can go off on the side to speak. Meanwhile, Russia is saying that indeed their relationship with China has never been better. Let us go now to a clip from Al Jazeera on all of this, and then we'll have our panelists weigh in.
It was inevitable that Donald Trump's arrival would dominate the APEC summit. After getting off the plane from a state visit to Beijing, the United States president went to a meeting of political and business leaders. There he went straight on the offensive, seeming to attack China's trade policies without specifically mentioning China.
They engaged in product dumping, subsidized goods, currency manipulation, and predatory industrial policies. They ignored the rules to gain advantage over those who followed the rules, causing enormous distortions in commerce and threatening the foundations of international trade itself.
Trump has vowed to correct some of the trade deficits the United States has built up, particularly in Asia. But the America First policy that he campaigned on ahead of last year's election is seen as protectionist. It runs counter to the multilateral globalist approach of most other APEC nations, including China. President Xi Jinping spoke soon after Trump and painted China as a champion of globalization.
Openness brings progress, while seclusion leaves one behind. We, the Asia-Pacific economies, know this too well from our own development experience. We should put in place a regional cooperation framework that ensures consultation among equals with participation and shared benefits.
That's what it's trying to do with the 16-nation trade bloc known as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which may be finalized by the end of the year. Under the previous administration, the United States was also hoping to gain some influence in this region through the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, but Donald Trump pulled out of it. The remaining 11 members of the pact, which doesn't include China, are hoping to come to some sort of agreement during APEC. TPP members quietly hope the United States will eventually rejoin, but under President Trump, that's unlikely.
All righty. So there you go. And the source of that is Al Jazeera. Jackie Goldberg, we'll start this round with you because we know that Trump pulled out of the TPP. TPP was also the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, also opposed by generally by Bernie Sanders and other progressives. But you heard very, very different messages now from Trump and his isolationism, his America First, and chiding countries in the region, from President Xi of China, who has a different story, who is talking about globalization, who's talking about multilateralism, while Trump is basically trying to say we'll only be bilateral and only do country-to-country agreements. And meanwhile, Trump, as I said, trying to kind of get a wedge going between like India and China and perhaps even Russia and China. But Jackie Goldberg, your take on this trip thus far?
Well, I think there's been more sound and fury signifying very little, perhaps not nothing, but very, very little. In China, there was more just two big shots praising each other, telling each other what great guys they are. But I think that Trump is foolish in that he believes that, like in hotel deals, getting people to trust each other, quote unquote, or like each other is the way you make a deal. I don't think there's any of that in China. I think Xi is very clear about what he wants to happen, which is a growing presence, not just in Asia, but in the rest of the world. And he wants to do that through multilateral trade. I think that, and the fact that, for example, Australia has already said in Vietnam that they're for multinational trade and a multilateral system, all of these things indicate that the United States is moving further and further away from what the rest of the world seems to think is the way that the global economy should be organized. And I think that Trump believing that somehow or another he can go to various countries after calling China the raper, the rapist of the United States repeatedly during the election, I was shocked, really, at how with his statement saying that the trade imbalance, which was, I think, something like $27 billion in October in the favoring China, was not China's fault, but the fault of previous presidents of the United States. I thought that particular statement was designed for Trump to say to China, well, you know, we're going to blame other people for any problems that come up. But I think China was very quick to say through Xing that Xi Jinping, that's not the case, that they have very big differences, that they have differences on how they look at banking, they have differences at how they look at multilateral trade, and I think that those differences didn't go away, and the coverage shows that this trip may have only further moved the United States from a position of leadership economically in the world.
Yes, and Laura Carlson, BuzzFeed's headlined is Trump's plan to make America great just derailed in China. And they make the case that people are really, while on the one hand, not quite trusting China because China is such a huge power on the one hand, but also very, very unsure about Trump. And they're saying that if you look at how Trump is treating Canada and Mexico, that basically he's tossing them under the bus, much less. And they're like right on the border, much less people in the region. And Chile, Mexico and Peru are there as part of the APEC meetings. And one has to wonder what a pull aside or a bilat would look like there. Laura Carlson, your take on this trip?
Well, first of all, I think we have to break it down, and especially in regards to the BuzzFeed headline. I've never been a fan, I think many of us are not, of the whole America First or Make America Great slogan, and would really welcome a return someday to a concept of foreign policy of make America peaceful, happy, and well off. And certainly this is not what's happening on this tour at all. This was not the tour of a statesman. It was the tour of a businessman, and of a businessman with a very limited vision. He came out of it celebrating success in China with some $250 billion in major deals that go straight to his cronies. So it's not America first tour, but a Trump and his cronies first tour in that sense. And Tillerson is right and very candid to say that this is really just purchases, and that they do nothing to structurally change the deficit, which is probably not as big a problem as Trump makes it out to be, and they do nothing to really change the economic relationship. In fact, if you look, even amid all these headlines and clapping each other on the back, if you look at what some of the goals were supposedly going into this China tour of breaking into greater access for investment in certain parts of the country, talk about investment in the United States or structurally changing the deficit, none of those things really even came up in a public way, and much less getting China on board to pressure North Korea. So you have a president that goes in and shakes hands and makes some private deals and does not take on any of the supposed problems in the relationship that he himself has highlighted before, and then goes out and then criticizes China after he gets out of the country. So China is very pragmatic in this sense. China doesn't get mad, it gets even. So we'll see in the long run what comes out of this. I think the second thing that's important is that is highlighted by his visit to the Philippines, where you have an utterly appalling violation of human rights. There were protesters out calling to ban Trump. They're concerned that there will be agreements for more military bases and that they will be dragged into a confrontation with North Korea. And then Duterte is someone who should not even be recognized on the international scene. And there's Trump praising the country along with the other countries in the region and calling out, and I think this is important too, praising the Philippines for its attitude toward women. When we begin to see this kind of a gender perspective used in such a politicized and narrow sense, when thousands of women are being exploited in sweatshops, when human beings are being killed on the streets in extrajudicial executions, we have to really call it out wherever it happens. And then finally, the issue of trying to promote bilaterals in the context of regionalization. This bilateral emphasis of the Trump team is just a bully's way of avoiding a more equal situation for statesmanship.
Right, and Dr. Gerald Horn, just picking up also on Laura's last point, and also there is talk about this bilat between Putin and Trump, not a formal meeting, either that or a pull-aside. Meanwhile, Russia's sovereign wealth fund said Friday that Russia was enjoying its best ever relationship with China. So if Trump is hoping for any wedge there, that might not be the case. And there are also reports that the U.S. and Russia are about to cut some kind of deal in relation to Syria. And also, finally, Dr. Horn, the Trump administration has been going on about punishing Venezuela, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. But meanwhile, Russia has come in and really offered a loan to Venezuela to help with the financial crisis there. So, and also the context of it now coming out from Trump's bodyguard that indeed they had been approached when they were in Russia about Russia sending prostitutes, five women, to Trump's room. And he said, well, I accompanied Trump to the room. We both laughed about it. But then he said he didn't know what happened afterwards. So who knows if Russia has any honeypot goods, as it's put, on Trump. Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, a footnote on that Venezuela story. Because of the turmoil in Saudi Arabia with the crown prince arresting a good deal of his fellow members of the elite, there's a strong possibility that the price of a barrel of oil will go up to $70 or $75 by the end of the year, which is good news for Venezuela, Russia, Nigeria, Angola, and, of course, Saudi Arabia. But bad news for drivers, I would say, particularly in Southern California, who might be paying more for a gallon of gasoline at the pump. Now, with regard to this Trump trip to Asia, as noted, there are basically two trends. One, China is number one, and two, the encirclement of China by the United States, Japan, Australia, and India, which you see reflected in that term you cited, Indo-Pacific, which is a kind of new word that has been invented to incorporate this new strategy. Certainly, there's been a lot of hyperbole and hysteria on this side of the Pacific about the rise of China. I really recommend this article in the New York Times a few days ago, which suggested that within a few years, that China will be leading in quantum computing and green energy and robotics, and the particularly crucial field of artificial intelligence, and the United States will be left to export soybeans, oil, and waste paper to China. I'm not sure what that means for our working class, that kind of dystopian scenario. The trade deals that were announced, apparently the headline figure was $250 between China and the United States, is on the one hand a sort of chump change for China, believe it or not. On the other hand, as noted, you really can't take that figure seriously because some of these deals were already in the works. Some of these deals, you don't know if they're ever going to be completed. I think that instead, listeners should pay attention to the fact that a major Chinese firm has just bought a major stake in Snap of Venice, California, which is one of California's leading technology firms. And secondly, that a Singapore firm, and of course Singapore is very close to the People's Republic of China, is seeking to buy Qualcomm of San Diego, which of course manufactures chips, which are important in our smartphones and virtually every other high-tech device. If that goes through, that will tell you which way the winds are blowing. Certainly, Donald J. Trump's trip to Vietnam is important for the encirclement strategy because the United States would like to enlist Vietnam in this encirclement strategy. The problem is that his line of America first does not really resonate, particularly compared to the Chinese line of win-win. Mr. Trump has attained the rather impossible goal of uniting left, right, and center in a number of countries against the United States of America, including the northern neighbor, Canada, where the United States threatened to slap three-digit tariffs on Bombardier, this Quebec airplane manufacturing firm, which then had to sell out to Airbus, which then said it would manufacture Bombardier planes in Alabama. That means that Canada will suffer a job loss, which is why left, right, and center in Canada are united against the United States of America. I think it's rather ironic that at the same time that the U.S. press is dancing on the grave of the Russian Revolution and the Soviet experiment of the 100th anniversary in 2017, that at the same time the U.S. press is really being hysterical about China as number one, China led by a Communist Party. It seems that they need to bridge that gap if they're going to make sense to their readers.
Yeah, so here you have two nations, well, alleged communist nations, although clearly strongly capitalist also in Russia and China. So we'll see how all of this plays out. Thank you for that, Dr. Gerald Horn. We are going to take a short station break, and when we return, our panelists are going to stay with us, and we are going to be discussing the tax plan, the recent elections and what they may mean, and also this scandal scandals that are breaking out all over the place, it seems, of men in power not really being able to control themselves when it comes to women or even men on men. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Peace to keep the world alive and war to cease. We gotta have joy within our hearts with love we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows.
And the great Curtis Mayfield and the song We gotta have peace. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And I encourage you to subscribe for a free podcast where you could listen to the show anytime and any place. And we would also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where all of our shows, our back shows, are archived. And also on our website, our shows are archived there, and a lot more information on both our website and on our Facebook page. And just on Facebook, just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we are also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Asia Pacific region. Our SoundCloud listeners, yes, we do have some in the Asia Pacific region. Actually, just for our audience here to know, that Sojourner Truth is heard in Southern California, but also several other U.S. cities, about 20 or so on a regular basis. But also we have a very large international listenership on SoundCloud. Last I heard, I think it was something close to 50,000 or some such. So that's very good that the word is getting out, not only around the nation, but also around the world. We work hard, and I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team for all of their efforts. Now, it is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. And we're now going to go on to the tax plan. Both the Republican House and Senate have been working on their own versions of the tax plan. The House Ways and Means Committee approved the bill, their version, on Thursday. All committee Republicans voted yes. All committee Democrats voted no. And now it's been sent to the full House, and they're hoping for a vote next week. However, the Senate Republicans unveiled their own plan on Thursday, a plan which the Joint Committee on Taxation estimates will increase the federal deficit by nearly $1.5 trillion over a decade. And Trump has said he wants this legislation passed and on his desk by the end of the year. Let us get a roundup now from Bloomberg about the very tax plans.
There's major differences between the House proposal and the Senate proposal. Let's start with those differences. First and foremost, the Senate version of the bill, according to headlines crossing the terminal as we speak, would keep seven tax brackets. You'll remember that the administration had originally proposed limiting the number of tax brackets from the seven as it is now to three. The House version of that bill keeps it at four. So the Senate wants to keep the number of tax brackets at seven. Another major difference is when the lowering of the corporate tax rate would actually go into effect. Now, the House version of the bill would implement that lower corporate tax rate, a deduction from 35% to 20% next year. But the Senate version of the bill would not implement that lower corporate tax rate until 2019. Now, they're doing that as a way to raise revenue to cover and pay for this plan. But as we all know, that these are major differences that have since emerged from the House version of the bill to the Senate version of the bill. Publicly, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin telling our very own Michael McKee earlier this week in a Bloomberg exclusive interview that they would be okay, suggesting they would be okay, rather, with some of these differences that are being proposed in the Senate version. But whether or not we can get to a point of reconciliation by the end of the year or early calendar next remains to be seen.
We're also hearing that the Senate plan would keep seven tax brackets as well, Kevin. And the other thing we're hearing is that the Obamacare individual mandate repeal is still being considered. They're waiting for the Joint Committee on Taxation to tell the House Ways and Means Committee how much they would actually reap from that. So we could have a very different picture just by the end of the day today, what is included in these bills and what's excluded.
I spoke with several sources in the past week who told me, Vani, that should healthcare get entangled in the tax reform debate, you can almost make a certain bet that that would limit any centrist Democrats from being able to participate or get on board with the tax version of the bill. I can also tell you that I got a statement earlier today from Steve Bannon, the president's former chief strategist, now outside of the White House running a conservative advocacy group, who said that he's on board with the three-year phase-in, so to speak, of the carried interest rule. Now, a lot of hedge fund managers are against that. We still don't know specifically if the Senate version would have that in it as well.
All righty, there you go. And that is from Bloomberg News. Jackie Goldberg, we will start with you again on this round and get your take on these tax plans, who the winners are, who are the losers. What are your thoughts now that we know what is in the Senate or bill, or at least a lot of what is in the Senate bill?
I think there are two things that are not being talked about. The first is that when you take $1.5 trillion out of the tax income, eventually what you're looking for are ways to deal with the debt, because that's the next thing that will come, and that will come in the following years, and they will start saying it's time to cut Medicare, it's time to cut Medicaid, it's time to cut any kinds of assistance to cities that have poor people, it's time to cut rural poor assistance. It's time to make major cuts to pay for this $1 trillion cut. That's the first thing not being talked about. The second thing that's not being talked about is the fact that the middle class tax cut, quote unquote, is not really a permanent tax cut. These disappear each year, and these changes, Ryan is always talking about the $59,000 income family is going to do really well on this. Well, the best they ever do is in the first year, and that would save them maybe about $100 a month. That's about it. As opposed to the literally billions of dollars that will be saved by people who no longer have to pay an alternative minimum tax. That includes, for example, Trump himself, who in 2005 would have saved $31 million if the current law existed. So what's happening is that beginning about 5 years out, the middle class tax cuts begin to disappear. And by 2023 or 2024 at the latest, that's not very far from now, it is actually a middle-class tax increase to help pay for the tax decreases to the wealthy. The differences between the two is basically the Senate wants to delay the changes to the corporate rate for about a year, that they include more small businesses in getting the pass-through of the 25% for businesses, that they keep seven brackets, and they leave the estate tax in place, although now, of course, you will be able to not have to pay taxes on the first $11 million per person or maybe $22 million in your estate. I think the other thing not being mentioned is that this amount of debt will be financed, and where will it be financed from, and what will the costs be? So there is a tremendous amount of chicanery in this, because it really isn't what it set out to be. It was set out to make the tax codes more simple. It really doesn't do that. It was designed, in quotes they said, for the biggest tax cut in history. It won't do that. It says that it's basically going to create an economy in which your wages will go up more than $4,000 a year for the average working person. We have from the last big tax cuts in the 1980s, that didn't happen. So there's a lot of lying and cheating going on about this, but my big fear is that something is going to get passed. And if it gets passed, that what we're going to be facing in the year following it being passed is now all of the people who voted for it will say, oh, my God, that we're spending too much money. Time to cut Medicare. Time to cut Medicaid.
Right. And, of course, the New York Times is still, and it seems to be the general view, except from Republicans, that both bills, the House and the Senate plans, according to the Times, quote, are unfavorable to people living in high-cost states that are Democratic bastions, and that they both provide deep cuts for the richest,
Right.
While helping others, you know, far less. Now, Laura Carlson, just segueing a little on this, because given where you're based, I wondered, this sort of takes us a little bit into the some of the issues around the election, but I did want you to have an opportunity to talk about this rescinding of the TPS status for Nicaraguans and other issues on the refugee cap. So let's segue a little into that, Laura Carlson.
Regarding immigration, our steps forward in this restrictionist anti-immigrant agenda that Trump has been applying relentlessly, although in some ways different than what many people expected. So we have the rescinding of the temporary protective status for Nicaraguans only. This is a relatively small number of people, actually, about 5,000, but they're people who have been in the country for decades. And at the same time, there are a couple other things that happened. First of all, they suspended the same decision for Hondurans, and that, in fact, ended up to be a big kind of a scandal in the administration, because apparently John Kelly pressured acting Homeland Security Director Elaine Duke to rescind the status for the much larger group of Hondurans as well, and she postponed that decision, and now there's talk that she may even resign because of that outright pressure. I think in this sense we're seeing, again, the true colors of John Kelly, who some people have thought that was a little softer on immigration, but that, in fact, is pushing to go forward on disrupting these families who've been in the country as a result of catastrophes in their home countries for over a decade in many cases. At the same time, they stopped the program to process child refugee status in-country in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. So again, this is not a very large number of people, but they're getting the ground cleared to be able to get rid of protective status for Central American child migrants who are making it to the United States as well. And this is a big deal. These are children. I just got returned from Honduras about 4 days ago, and these are children who are facing serious death threats, who are fleeing gang violence and state violence and other types of life-threatening situations, and for whom these protections are very important in terms of making sure that they're not returned to almost a certain death, which we already unfortunately have examples of having happened to children and young people who have been deported eventually from the United States. And then finally, there's a 45,000 person refugee cap as part of this, which is down from over 100,000 in the Obama administration at a time when across the globe we're seeing this huge increase in the needs and the numbers of refugee populations. So we have the United States going countercurrent in any kind of a humanitarian response to refugee needs, and especially cracking down on those that are coming as a result of its own disastrous policies in what it still continues to regard as its backyard throughout Latin America.
Right. Thank you for that, Lauren. Of course, with the specter of the 2018 elections, midterm elections coming up, and so many Republicans actually leaving the House, some leaving the Senate, and we can segue a bit also, Dr. Horn, into the election results, the issue of immigration and this TPS status bound to be an issue that both parties are going to have to deal with. Thank you, Laura. Now, Dr. Horn, your views on the tax plan, but also let's segue a bit into the election day. Our revolution candidates, Bernie Sanders candidates, won seats across the country on Tuesday. A lot of women, people of color, some openly trans candidates won, two holding seats on the Minneapolis City Council. And then Elizabeth Guzman, one of the first Latinas to be elected to Virginia's General Assembly. And of course, the two big wins in the governor's race House in Virginia, the Democrat Ralph Northam defeating the Republican candidate, and also in New Jersey, Phil Murray elected governor of New Jersey. So Dr. Horn, any thoughts on the tax plan, but also what these election results could portend?
Well, first of all, with regard to the elections, it was certainly an anti-Trump earthquake, not least in Virginia, where Hillary Rodham Clinton won by 5 to 6 points, and Ralph Northam, the successful gubernatorial candidate, basically doubled that figure. The Democrats may wind up winning the legislature as well. The problem for the GOP in Virginia is similar to the problem it faces in California. That is to say, how does the party of whiteness win Asian and Latino voters, particularly on an anti-immigrant platform? I think that if you look at the map, the electoral map of the state of Virginia, you'll see most of the state is blood red. But the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C., in that technology corridor heading towards Dulles Airport, it's blue, and it's, of course, is heavily populated by Asian and Latino immigrant populations, ditto for Richmond in the center of the state and the Tidewater area, Virginia Beach, Newport News, et cetera. It seems as if Virginia will be lost to the Republicans for all time, not unlike California, but time will tell. Speaking of which, you now have on the west coast of the United States, in light of the fact that in this election this past Tuesday, there was a flip of a state legislature seat in the state of Washington, a blue west coast from Seattle to San Diego, with the prospect of enacting very potent climate change legislation. However, don't uncork the champagne yet. The GOP still has a lock in terms of national races, presidential races in particular, on large on states with large Native American presence, such as the Dakotas, Nebraska, Wyoming, Idaho. And of course, they have a lock on the former slave states from North Carolina headed towards Texas. So obviously, a serious progressive movement has to meet that issue head on. Now, with regard to the tax plan, the House and Senate plans both would get rid of what they contemptuously call the estate tax, that is to say, I mean, the death tax, which is the estate tax, which would allow the generational transfer of wealth to lazy inheritors. It also would repeal the Johnson Amendment, which seeks to circumscribe the ability of clerics, pastors, imams, and rabbis to engage in politics through their congregations, pointing the United States, quite frankly, towards an open theocracy. It would also tend to eliminate the medical expense deductions, which, quite frankly, could lead to people dying. And I should also say, generally speaking, it's a boon for the investor class and an attack on Donald J. Trump's base. And listeners may want to scratch their heads and try to figure out, how does he get away with it? Particularly when you see that when, as Trump did, he riled up his base against a wing of the elite, and then you would expect him to go after that elite, but instead he's giving tax breaks to George Soros and Warren Buffett and other billionaires. According to Paul Krugman in the New York Times this morning, the way he gets away with it is stoking racial animosity to distract the mostly white Trump base, and as of now, it seems as if that plan will work.
Right. And thank you, Dr. Horn. Other election news, of course, in Maine, nearly 60% of voters in Maine voted yes on a ballot proposal to expand Medicaid. It's the first state to do so. But their Republican Governor Paul LePage said that he would not carry out the Medicaid expansion, even though that was the will of the voters. So we'll have to see how all of that will play out. But Jackie Goldberg, the news breaking about Roy Moore, the GOP candidate for Senate in the state of Alabama, where he, you know, when he was elected, apparently he rode in on election day, rode in on a horse or something, and was seen brandishing his weapon, his gun. And apparently he was trying to brandish something else in front of a 14-year-old girl. But we'll see, you know, from the Fox News crew, Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes, to Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, the comedian now, Louis C.K., Dustin Hoffman, Steven Seagal, Ben Affleck. I mean, there is an epidemic, and I imagine a lot more of this is going to come out, about rape, downright rape, or just sexual assault by men in power. And it seems to be really a moment here in the U.S., but also some of that in the U.K. Any comments, Jackie Gilbert?
Well, I don't think it'll keep Roy Moore from being elected. They have a history in Alabama of electing people with dubious problems in their and scandals. They reelected a guy to their legislature who became the speaker of their lower house again after while he was indicted on 26 felonies. So I don't think it's going to change the outcome in Alabama. I do think, however, there is something afoot because more and more women are beginning to come forward, and whether it is about specific individuals or whether it's about the general problem that we women have faced in this country for a very long time, which is unwanted sexual advances, sexual assaults, rapes, and so forth, women have been very reluctant to talk about these things where big shots are concerned, where VIPs are concerned, because they're afraid no one will believe them. I think that is beginning to change. Though, of course, in places like Alabama, they're calling it fake news. So I think we are really seeing a change here. On the elections themselves, I want to say that the most hopeful part of the election last Tuesday really was the turnout. And I think that, and the number of people willing to run against incumbents, I think both of those things are going to have some significant changes for the particularly House of Representative elections in 2018. Out here in California, almost every Republican is facing a real opponent for the first time for Congress. We haven't done that in a long time. We've kind of conceded those seats. Those seats are no longer being conceded, and I think that's happening around the country, both because of Bernie Sanders and his groups, but also because of other organizations that came out of the Women's March and so forth. So what we really have is an attempt of people who are trying to translate their shock and dismay over having a person like Trump as president. They're trying to translate that into saying, well, let's reduce his power by taking away the Congress from him. And I think that I'm cautiously optimistic, even though there'll be a huge amount of money, that unless the tax bill tanks, if the tax bill tanks, then the Democrats do extraordinarily well in 2018.
Right. But if the tax bill doesn't tank,
then, of course, all of the rich will be rewarded for all the money they give to the party, and they will continue to give all that money to the party. The stock market yesterday, the Dow fell 101 points. Why? Because there's a beginning to be a feeling that maybe this is going to go the way of the health care reforms, so-called, in that they won't be able to get to the 50 votes. And if they can't get to 50 votes, then, of course, the vice president can't be the 51st vote.
Right. Well, on that note, sadly, we are out of time. I'd like to thank our team there, our panelists. And just on the election front, some good news also out of Philadelphia, which is that the Krasner, who was elected, Larry Krasner, as for the district attorney, he's anti-death penalty, he's anti-mass incarceration. He sued the police, and apparently people of color and millennials came out in droves, and he won by 75 percentage points. So that should send a warning to other district attorneys in Los Angeles and in other large cities. But we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. Today's show produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. We'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case. And our intern, Sherelle Withers, is on a much-needed break, and we hope that she is fitting in some rest, but we always want to mention and thank her. And, of course, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.